Welcome to the Real Estate Secrets Podcast. This show is about sharing lessons in commercial real estate that were learned from trial and error and working directly with CEOs of billion-dollar healthcare organizations. Our mission is to teach the insider strategies used by the big guys to everyday healthcare operators in order to get access to the best real estate at the best prices.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Commercial Real Estate Secrets, where I'm your host, Austin Hare. And I want to introduce our guest today, Ben Hernandez. Ben is the managing partner of Skytail Group. Skytail Group has been in business since 2018, and they are a healthcare-focused management consulting and sell-side M&A firm, which is a mouthful, but it simply means they help people in the healthcare industry buy and sell their practices, consolidate, and of course, they do a lot of management and consulting, especially from the financial side. So, Ben, I hope I got that right, and pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Austin. Been looking forward to this, and yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks again.
Okay, so let's backtrack. Let's get to know who is Ben. Like, what makes you tick? Let's go all the way as early as you can remember. I just like getting to know people from a entrepreneurial childhood level. I mean, like, what do you think happened in your childhood? Or did you have like entrepreneurial tendencies? Is there any stories that you can think of that were growing up that were like, oh yeah, maybe I'll be my own partner of a business one day, or I'll be an entrepreneur, or I'll be at least, maybe I'll figure out some way to make money, right? Like for me, it was selling golf balls by the golf course, like raking them out when I was in like fourth grade. And then, I would try to be the number one candy bar salesman in elementary school and stuff like that. I'm just curious, like if you had anything like that in your life too.
Yeah, no, wow, taking me back. So yeah, growing up, I think it's important to mention, you know, very close-knit family. My father came from kind of a line of academics, professors, teachers, and what that led to is a lot of engineers. He's one himself. So very risk averse, very conservative. And then you have my mother, who's, she comes from a line of entrepreneurs. So it was almost like opposites truly attracting in this case. And I got to see both of them. And I was always more attracted to the entrepreneurial side of my family. You know, they were a bit more eccentric, definitely risk takers, loved the way that they viewed the world. They viewed it as something that they could truly mold, and not just part of the world, but they could have an effect on it. So very early on, I think I wanted to be something, you know, that had, you know, that entrepreneurial spirit in it. You know, for you, it was golf balls. I wish I would have thought of that. For me, it was video
100%
games.
Margin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to pick up balls from people like me who were probably just, you know, slicing them all over the place. No, for me, it was video games. One thing I realized was, you know, as our friends would play with them after a couple months, they'd get bored of them. So I would trade them or find a way to buy from them the ones I didn't care about and sell them to other friends that I knew wanted them and didn't want, their parents maybe didn't want to pay for it, et cetera. Didn't want to take them to Toys R Us. I don't know if your audience even knows what Toys R Us is, but it was a store that sold video games. And so that was one that for me got exciting to see if I could make margin on it and, you know, kind of beat the market, if you will, at that point in time. And the market was made up of my friends. It was fun.
That's cool. So yeah, it taught you some principles early on.
It did.
Yeah, I think that's super important. So, and then like, you know, in high school, or did you have anything that led you to kind of start thinking about what you were going to do when you were in college, when you graduated from college? Like, what was that decision-making progress like that started to lead you down the path that you're on now?
Yeah, so, you know, in high school, the entrepreneurial stuff kind of went by the wayside. And what I mean by that is my father very much had the opinion of your job is to get good grades, get into, you know, a good school, graduate, like that's my promise to you, and you can go ahead and dream later. That was a little bit of it. My mother was not that way. So, you know, during high school and college, spent a lot of time wondering what I was going to do. And, at that point in time, I thought I wanted to do something like, the movie Wall Street. That really attracted me, you know, maybe a big business person. And that's what led me really ultimately into finance. And I also knew that with that degree, it was it was important, right? Especially accounting. It's like the language of business. So I knew it was important, but I also knew that it wouldn't pigeonhole me into any one specific thing and could maybe propel me from there. So pretty early on, I knew I wanted to do something in the financial world.
I'm always curious, like, about the physical structure of people's days. You know, it seems like there's some people start earlier than others. Like, some people start later, where it's like the waking up early. Like, some people just have a drive, like, you know, some athletes in elementary school, right? Like, they're just go, working, all, and they do their sports all day long. Other people, they kind of hit their stride later, and like, they slack off in college, honestly, and they sleep in, and they do all these things, and then later on in life, they'll kick it into gear. But at some point, like, there's a transition that, like, okay, I got to kind of be intentional with my time. I got to wake up early. I got to plan things out. I got to be structured. You know, there's a intense, like, appetite to learn and be productive. Like, did you know that did you always have that? Did that come later in life? Like, you know, where did that happen for you?
That's interesting. So it started and then it stopped and then it started. And here's what I mean. Like, you know, in high school, I had that. And I think a lot of that was really driven by, one, my family, making sure that I didn't disappoint them, but two, sports as well. It was always competitive and you know, wanting to compete really against myself to see what I could do. In college, I lost that. I went to Texas A&M, big school, and I was like the furthest thing away from being a D1 anything. So, you know, in college, you know, got decent grades, but certainly was not what I was in high school and certainly was not what I am today. So, relatively speaking, maybe slacked off a little bit in college. And what made it tick again after college was I was trying to find that competitive spirit of, okay, I'm getting too old for sports. I'll tear anything if I try to make any sudden movements today. Like, what's my new sport? And I found business to be that, like exactly what we're doing today, like competing to be the best for our team, for our clients, you know, for the healthcare space in general. And that really is what now just drives me 24 hours a day. So I kind of found my new sport post-college.
Yeah, and it's funny that you bring that up, because I was a professional wakeboarder for a long time, and I found that there was like two types of athletes. Mm-hmm. There were the guys who wanted to give the impression that they didn't have to work hard, you know what I mean, that they were just gifted, and they wanted to make it very obvious that, like, they were, you know, like, it was kind of like a better than you type thing, right? And like, that didn't translate well after sports at all, because there was a huge sense of entitlement. But there was the other guys who were really motivated to work hard, right? And so the guys who worked really hard, that carries through, that work ethic carries through much after, long after sports, because you can put that into something else. And so, not always, but a lot of times, a lot of the really successful people came from sports, because you've got that same hunger, that same competitive drive. That's the same, whether it's, you know, on the field, or in my case, on the lake, or in the business field.
Love that. Yeah, I didn't know that about you, Austin. Yeah. So that's fascinating. And yeah, you're right. Actually, my brother was one of those that he was never, he would never brag about it, but he was one of those who was naturally talented. And he got like first state goalkeeper, actually received scholarships to college. And he was the opposite of me. Like, I would try really, really hard to break a starting lineup, and he didn't have to try at all. And it was always something that I was like, boy, if I had your talent, right? I'm sure you've heard that a million times. But it's paid off, because now in business, I treat it the same way. I never feel like I get there. So, you know, you're always motivated by it. But yeah, that's funny you mentioned that.
Yeah, yeah. My brother. Yeah, like, you can make up for talent with work ethic, for sure, right? It's like, both are like spectrum, like work ethic and talent, like, are always kind of undulating, but I think, you know, work ethic always outweighs talent every time. So let's talk about, so after college, what was your first kind of professional stint in the, you know, your in a job or business or whatever? Like, what was the difference? What happened between college and between when you started SkyTel Group, or started managing SkyTel Group?
Yeah, so between college and starting SkyTel Group, I'm going to age myself here. But I'll try to keep it short. So after college, I did investment banking for a couple of years, and went back and received my MBA here at SMU in Dallas, actually. And then post-MBA, I worked at HBK, which is a hedge fund with a few offices, but it's based out of Dallas by chance. So worked there for still most of my career. And it was there that I met one of my buddies. His wife was a partner at the time at MWA, Mike White and Associates. So, you know Mike. So moved over there. Yeah, so MWA was, they sold to CLA since, but they were an accounting, tax, and advisory firm. Went over there to the advisory department, eventually led it. And by total dumb luck, and this is the most fortunate thing that's happened in my professional life, like I walked in there and I'm like, what is a Zurich machine? And how am I going to help a single dental office? I don't know. This was 2015. And this is the dumb luck part. A lot of our clients were asking about multi-location, you know, dental groups and how do I monetize it and sell it to, you know, private equity or a financial sponsor. And, you know, I thought, okay, that I understand. Like some of my past had led me to that of, okay, I understand fragmented markets, really interesting, you know, in this case, healthcare subsectors that are going to consolidate. So, you know, we put together a nice package for our clients to be able to help them grow and scale. And then eventually realized, you know what, I really would love to only focus on multi-location and also sell side from an investment banking perspective. My past kind of allowed me to work with private equity right off the bat. So that's where SkyTel was born out of. It was really, you know, Mike helped propel that. And, you know, that's kind of what we do today is we only work with multi-location groups within healthcare. And we also, you know, help sell them if they choose us to do so.
All right. So, yeah, let's talk through that. So when you say multi-location, does that mean two or like, is there a minimum somewhere?
Yeah, great question. We're agnostic on the number of locations. What we do ask is, so a typical phone call for us, probably average walking in, is probably around 3.5 locations. Somewhere between 3 and 4 locations is a typical starting point. And then usually we try to figure out their why, right? And we try to take it away from the number of locations into something else, because number of locations can mean a lot of things and it doesn't touch on a lot of things we like to touch on, efficiency and, you know, replication and the like. So usually it's about 3 to 4 when they come in. The one thing we do ask for is that they do have a hunger and thirst for growing and scaling their team. And usually that does mean additional locations. Usually that does mean a bigger team and embracing, you know, everything from people issues to consistency to really having a nice roadmap as to why they're doing it.
So they'll come in, you said on average, like 3 to 4 locations. And then is there an average number that you try and get to or they try and get to before they'll sell or recapitalize?
Yeah, I think a really nice sweet spot for our clients before they say, you know what, I'm going to de-risk and hand it off to someone else to add a little bit of fuel to this fire I've created is usually around 10 to 15 locations, usually around that 2.5 to 5 million EBITDA. That's around the time that they've hit whatever their internal goal is, whether it is a number of locations or number of people that they've been able to help, or whether it is as simple as, hey, when I get to $30 million enterprise value, that's my number.
Okay. All right. So what are, like, I got two questions. What's a commonly held belief, you know, in this space that you disagree with? And the follow-up question is, like, what are people doing? What's the typical bottleneck when they come in and see you? So we'll go through those one at a time.
Great. Yeah, I think a commonly held belief is actually what we're talking about right now. Usually we get a phone call and it's like, I have 4 locations, I'm going to 10 or 15. And we like to say, okay, like I'm not a big fan of growth for the sake of growth. We try to back up and our first meeting reflects all of this, by the way. We try to back up and really say, okay, understood. That's great, Austin. Where are you today, though? And why are you getting to 10 or 15? What does that mean? What we're really trying to get to is more of an EBITDA number, a revenue number, an efficiency number, all of these things that when someone says, you know, I have 10 locations and they're very proud, that could be great. And it could be you have 2% margin, yeah, which is not very impressive to anyone.
Then you just have a big business, right? Your margins are so thin.
Exactly. So what we're really aiming for is to really figure out why they want to do it. And usually that's, let's go back to the beginning, you know, everything from why did you go to dental school or whatever it may be to why are you here today? And really try to figure out the DNA that they want the group to be. And then from there, we start building out. So we're taking it from number of locations, let's say, to, okay, got it. You know what? I want it to be 2026. And I want to have 4 million of EBITDA and this many employees and this many patients served. And then we get into a lot of the discussion of, okay, who are you? Let's just, for example, say, okay, are we only pedo-ortho? Then let's only focus on that. Let's make a commitment to each other that you're not going to call me and say, hey, there's an endo group down the street for sale. So we're really trying to
That's
drive
good.
consistency. We're trying to drive replication because that's what people pay you for, right? Like, for example, if you opened up a restaurant and you said, hey, Ben, here are my 100 recipes, probably all of them are average. Whereas, you know, we're in Texas, Austin, I have to use brisket as the example. If you tell me, like, Ben, I'm the best brisket maker in the United States, you're probably going to be a very, very famous restaurant because you figured out your one thing. And that's really what we try to get our groups to do is like figure out how do you treat your people, your patients, why are you doing what you're doing, what do you focus on from a service perspective. And once you have that, it really just provides a really nice compass for you.
Yeah, that's good. So, and we kind of touched on it, but in terms of like bottlenecks, like are there a couple when groups come to you, like they obviously they want to go from 3 to 10 or 15 locations. Like, are there some commonalities where you can go through, and like in general, like you could say like these are probably like the top three things that we need to focus on and fix?
Yes. One is because, you know, again, our groups are trying to grow, they're trying to scale, they're trying to add. One is bank debt funding. So, you know, usually our groups, especially if they're not performing very well, if they're taking too many distributions, whatever it may be, bank debt funding as we look forward, how are you getting from here to there? That's one wall that we always have to scale. Two is going to be people, right? And that ebbs and flows. Like right now, for example, in dentistry, it's hygienists. Nobody can find a hygienist. And by the way, like I think like industry metrics are the payroll percentage has probably gone up about 2% during what we're going through today. So margins are changing overall for dentistry, we think. And that's what we're seeing, and that's what I think some of our peers are seeing. But you know, people is always, you know, a big number two. And then number three, pretty much always is as you grow, as you scale, our clients tend to be, you know, they're brilliant. They went to dental school, they went to medical school. They're brilliant at what they do. Just as if I went in there and I tried to speak their language, they would think, you know, this guy's not very talented. They didn't, however, go to business school. They didn't, however, have that training for how do I become an executive? So that's a big number three. As you build out your team, you know, you're not physically there all the time. How do I get to when I have 50 employees, 80 employees, 100 employees? How do I get to where I still know what's going on in all my locations, where I trust my people? And by the way, where my people know what they're responsible for. I, sitting in this chair, know what Austin expects of me and what success means. And when you're able to do that, it just becomes a beautiful, it's almost like a symphony when
Yeah, so
everybody can work
how can
together
we
there.
talk through a little bit how you guys do that?
Sure, yeah. So on that last point, the way that we do that is, you know, our team, the way that we build our team is really having consultants that have been there and done that. So you can tell from my background, I can say, well, Austin, per Harvard Business Review number 2000, here are some thoughts, right? Where I think, you know, we help a lot is our people have been within those four walls, both at the practice level and at the management company level. So the way that we help do that is we have a lot of conversations around, okay, as you come out of the chair and into the executive role, first of all, we need to plan for that. We need to talk about, you know, pay home and bringing in a new doctor and making sure your staff's okay with it and making sure we tackle the questions head on of, oh, Dr. Austin, you're going corporate now. So that's one of the ways. You know, the other way is really being able to know who do you need at the management team level today? And depending on what your aspirations are for growth, a different, you know, junctions, you're going to need different team members. So who do you need today? Who do you need tomorrow? And be sure that we're planning out for that appropriately, and we're bringing in those team members at the right times. And what do you bring in-house? And what do you outsource? And then once you have all these people, the big, big key in that is, do they know what they're responsible for? So full clarity is super important.
You guys use in our US opinion, the traction system?
That's what we use here in the office, yes, ourselves. And then a lot of our clients do use that. And whether they use it or not, a lot of the components we bring in are exactly that, meaning there are some people who call us daily. We have a monthly meeting, though, and that's a nice way for you and I to both hold each other accountable. Like, we each said we were going to do XYZ. Did we do XYZ? And we have initiatives, and it keeps us away from like the shiny stuff, if you will. So yeah, we add a lot of those components with our clients, among other things. Okay. You're right.
Okay. And I didn't mean to cut you off. Were you finishing a thought there?
Oh, no. So really, it just comes down to, does everyone know what they're responsible for? One. And then in order to have that, from a CFO perspective, we need numbers, we need data. So we're projecting everything out for our clients, with our clients, down to the KPI level. So then when next month hits and we say, hey, we were down in this office, and by the way, we have master KPIs, and maybe it was due to patients. And when I dig into patients, it's due to new patients. And let's talk about, we just hired somebody new that's in charge of that. Do they know what they're like? So we're able to have all these questions where it's really about the story behind the data, to take away any of that subjectivity of whether you like someone or not. It's truly, hey, look, these are the people responsible for this number, for this metric, and then start correcting and start tightening. And when you do that over and over and over again, and everybody knows what they're responsible to, then they know the number and they know whether they succeeded or not ahead of time, before even we do. So that's kind of how we marry the operational and the financial together.
Yeah. And it seems like, I'm going to be painting with broad brushstrokes here, but it seems like you've got two kinds of people, two types of CEOs. One is the relational type, who's really good at culture and bringing people together, and they may or may not like numbers. A lot of times they don't, right? And then you've got the numbers-driven guys who are less like relational, and they have a harder time with the culture. And so it seems like it's not often the same person, right? Like, it's usually one or the other. Usually, maybe you could say the numbers guy is the CEO and the operations person is the manager, culture person, right? Or vice versa. Like, do you kind of see those types of things as well, those personality types?
Oh, 100%. And we even see it from our engagements, the way our clients use us. There are some that are so high level, such visionaries, that you can see, and we try to figure out, okay, how do we make their eyes not glaze over and get to the really important financial points where we're talking about strategic initiatives, but backed with numbers. And there are also those clients of ours that they love the numbers, and we can get really weedy with them, but then we really need to discuss, okay, someone needs to communicate this correctly, though. Like, when we do doctor rankings, for example, we always say to those type of clients, like, by the way, these aren't for you to use them and slap people on the wrist. These are meant to be motivational tools. Use them as best practices. Be careful how you communicate. So we absolutely have a mix of that. And we always try to suggest to them, like, hire for your weakness, right? Like, don't try. If you're not a visionary, hire for a visionary. If you're not into the weeds, then allow us to get into the weeds for you and with you, and maybe team up with your head of ops or whomever it may be to drive that change. So I think it's important for them to recognize, this is what I'm good at, what I'm not good at, this is what I like, what I don't like, and shed what you don't like, and let somebody who loves that to take the wheel.
Yeah, so I think I asked for two or three things. Was there a third thing that you're going to mention? Or I feel like we kind of wrapped a whole bunch of stuff up in there.
Yeah. So, like, one was bank debt financing. Yeah. Two was people hiring and retaining talent. Yeah. And then the third one was, yes, like, the responsibilities of the people and communication up down.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems like, for whatever reason, the most commonly talked about things would be finance. Everybody talks about finance and access to capital, right? Those are commonly heard phrases. Everybody talks about recruitment, like getting new people. But yeah, not a whole lot of people like talking about operations and your systems and your checklists and stuff like that. But I think it's hard to put a hierarchy on those things and which is more important, because they're just all three so important. So yeah, I love that. Let's talk about, well, first of all, yeah, several things I want to get through in our time today. Like, we do a lot with the, you know, dental space and urgent care and stuff like that. We don't do a whole lot with med spas. So how do you classify a med spa? Like, what's the typical square footage that you guys are working with? How would you, you know, what types of services? Is it office? Is it retail? Like, just some overarching themes about med spas.
Yeah, I would say a typical med spa that we deal with is probably around 2,500 square feet. You know, it's probably doing $1.5 million in revenues, probably, you know, 25% or so margins. And then margin, as far as the service,
is slightly better than dental, because dental, it seems like they're mostly around hovering around 20%.
Yes. Margins are better than dental in the med spa space. Yeah, correct. Like, it's not uncommon for us to see clients with 30% margins.
Wow.
And I'm talking true margins, like fully loaded owner. It's amazing. And by the way, one thing, Austin, that I always love about it is there's not insurance. So you don't have to, you know, you don't service me today and I pay you 60 days from now. It's I'm paying you right then and there.
Insurance is a real problem. I mean, it was great whenever dental started accepting insurance, so, you know, a while ago. I don't know how long ago it was. But, you know, and it's hard enough because they, in a normal environment, right, where you don't increase your reimbursement rates, but it's increasingly harder in an inflationary environment because the rates, the reimbursement rates are so far behind the inflationary rates. Yeah, it's a big problem, like, that people are going to have to solve. So I think that's a huge advantage for medical spas.
Yeah, agree. Yeah, just the service to cash in your bank account is almost immediate, which is a big plus. As far as service mix, I would say an average med spa is probably 50% injectables, meaning Botox, you know, what I think everybody knows. And then the rest of it are things like fillers, and these are higher margin things. So injectables have a pretty high cost of goods sold. If I inject a dollar into you, 40 cents is going out the window just on the product. So, you know, they're, but it keeps you coming back.
Right.
You know, people age like 20 years if they don't come back, you know, three times a year if they're doing Botox. So the nice thing about it is people keep coming back and they want to come back. They leave happy. That's another exciting thing about this space, right? Is like, when I go to my, you know, hygiene appointment, it's like, okay, it's a checkbox item. We see a lot of these people, like, they want to go there, they feel good, they come out, they think they're looking better, etc. So that's something that I think is pretty neat, just from a self-confidence level for some people. And then, you know, the other makeup of a med spa is, you know,
is
things like fillers,
young,
like I mentioned.
You get Botox from your clients?
Thank you, but no, I haven't done it yet. I'm not on the needle yet. No, I've been tempted. I think I probably should. I stare at myself all day and there are like a million flaws, but I haven't tried it yet.
Okay, so Botox, fillers, what are the other scopes of services that they offer?
Yeah, there's like Cool Sculpting, which, you know, kind of freezes your cells and helps you lose weight and things of that nature. Some of them do tattoo removal and not all that. I wouldn't call that a true, like, core med spa service. And then you have your things like, you know, chemical peels and the like that are more aesthetics in nature. So, you know, there's a nice mix there, but a lot of those, you know, truly are, you know, high margin
probably,
type of procedures.
Is it like 75% women or higher?
Yeah, it's probably a little higher right now, but actually that's another fascinating thing, Austin, is like 10 years ago, it was probably a 50-year-old female, probably wasn't promoting it, you know, it was quasi-taboo. Now you look at it, and from a demographic perspective, this part's exciting. I would have forgot to touch on this. So like the demographics are getting younger. So now it's like 20, 30-year-old females. It's now preventative,
yeah.
Right? It's not like I already have wrinkles. It's like I don't want wrinkles. This is how I'm going to look forever. And I don't have to do surgery. So it's really non-invasive, relatively speaking. But then males are getting into it too, which a decade ago was almost unheard of. So males are getting into it as well. So the market just keeps opening and opening and opening up. And I think it'll just continue to do so, which is why you see this fantastic growth rate in this space.
Well, there's
general.
What last I heard, 150,000 dentists in the U.S., 90,000 dental offices, and I could be off here, but it's just what I remember. Do you know how that compares to med spas?
Yeah, med spa is about 10% of that, if that.
So what? Yeah. And then the others, yeah, like I mean, that dental is somewhere between 30% and 50% conglomerated. Do you know how that compares to med spas?
Yeah, so it's actually almost impossible to touch to find that stat. So internally, we think it's around 3%. And the reason I say almost impossible to touch that stat is it's not at all yet consolidated. Now, you know, we are in a time where investors are definitely looking. We're getting a lot of phone calls about it. And we actually get more calls from investors on that than the dental space at this point in time, which a year and a half ago, I would have said, yeah, no chance I would ever say that, Austin, anytime soon. But I think it's kind of upon us.
Well, and I think it'll consolidate. Yeah, the word gets out. There's 25-30% margins. I mean, you know, right. Yeah. We won't bleep that part. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, that's what people do. They chase outsized returns, right? That's what everybody's trying to do in free market society. And so if there's like an outsized return, like the reward is greater than the risk that you're taking, eventually those margins are going to get compressed. Right. And then you got to go, you know, either normalize it or figure a value out or look for the next thing. So the takeaway is it's probably an exciting time to be in med spa, right? And there's still a lot of room for growth.
Yes, 100% on everything you said. I mean, it's growing about 15% a year. You compare that to dental, which is 3-4%. You know, we've gone through a couple of recessions here within the med spa space, and it held up nicely. That was, I know, one of my personal concerns is this something that people only spend money on whenever they have cash falling out of their treasure chest? And we have found that to not necessarily be the case. That's attractive. You mentioned the margins. And the people in it are fantastic as well. It's you know, very entrepreneurial. It's female driven, which is exciting. You know, I have a daughter, so it's fun seeing her have, you know, kind of role models, which is pretty fun. And then similar to dental, it's a lot of providers that are amazing at what they do. But from a professionalism perspective, like the way that private equity sees it, a long way to go. Because when you have 30% margins, you're not, you know, calling DirecTV to haggle over that. Well, you know, you can find a percentage point here and there, which translates into significant gains. And I think investors like that as well. There's a lot of low hanging fruit there.
Okay. Yeah, it's super interesting. So a lot of similarities for sure. In terms of bottlenecks for real estate, let's talk about that for a little bit. Would you consider the same, like they're occupying the same footprint, like, you know, 2,500 anywhere, it could be anywhere between 1,200 to 10,000 square feet, right? 7,000 square feet of like this retail space that's like, you know, you're going to look for good synergistic users or big anchor tenants. What are some of the bottlenecks there, and are they the same in both industries in your experience?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the bottleneck, if we're talking today's terms, when dealing with banks have become a little bit tighter on lending. So that's one thing to keep in mind. We've seen even some have shorter terms, like instead of doing a 10-year, they're doing a 5. You know, you can tell there's certainly some risk aversion going on here. Interest rates obviously is another one. Interest rates are going up. So if you're now getting into this space, it's significantly more expensive. So that's on the number side. I think on the operational side, the bottlenecks is exactly what you touched upon, which is who are we? Where do we want to go? What's our demographic? And being very, very disciplined to be sure that you wait to find the right one. Depending on what it is you are and who it is you are. And as an example, if you're maybe a Medicaid practice compared to a med spa, you're probably looking at two different spaces. So being able to be true to that, I think is super important. I think that the locations they look for, depending on the type of dentistry and the type of med spa, can be similar. meaning if it's a fee-for-service office, for example, that's probably similar to a med spa. You know, med spas are big on when you walk in, it has to smell good, it has to feel good, it has to look good, it has to flow nicely. And you know, you have to come in there and we're trying to give you a fantastic experience. It's very similar in dental. I think it just depends on demographic clientele that you're going after. As far as, you know, whether they are in the same vicinity or not.
Yeah. Do you have an opinion on buying real estate versus leasing for the groups?
Yeah. So usually what we say is whatever speaks to our clients, and then we provide them additional information beyond that. So number one, our job is to build their groups according to their thumbprint, right? Like it has to be something they're passionate about and believe in. If they ask us, like, just, you know, write it down without emotion or write it down on a spreadsheet, then I think what I would say is if you're going into high growth, hyper growth, then maybe leasing is the way to go. And the reason I say that is you leave capital, you free up capital, right? To continue to grow, to continue to scale, to continue to add team members and locations, you know, under with a lease agreement. That's less burdensome if you're looking at it that way. Not too dissimilar, by the way, as to how investors look at it, right? Like if private equity comes in, they're probably leaving the real estate alone because where they want to put their capital to work for outsized returns for what they want is, you know, add additional EBITDA, if you will, depending on the space you're in. Now, if you don't want to grow as quickly and you're a little bit more, you know, risk averse, or if you want mailbox money down the road, you know, when you do sell, going back to what we just talked about, you're going to be the landlord to whatever group buys you. So that's also very nice. So we see both. And I think a lot of it just has to do with how fast do you want to grow? How risk averse are you? And what are your goals? We personally don't have a strong opinion as to which is better, because what's better for one group is not going to be better for the other.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I, you know, we explain it the exact same way when people ask us renting versus buying. It depends on your growth goals. Yeah, like you said, hyper growth, quick scalability, you just, the real estate is going to bottleneck your ability to grow, right? It's going to slow you down. It's going to tie up your balance sheet, and it's going to limit your access to capital, or it's going to take up a lot of your capital when you're putting down these deposits. So the way we kind of look at it is like, if you have a single location and you're planning on staying at that location, it kind of makes more sense, right? You know, you are leasing to yourself as a tenant, so you're not that diversified because you still have to be in business to pay yourself. So it's not a huge diversification, but it is a little bit of diversification. But it's like, you know, if you're going to try and grow and scale fast, you know, and you're trying to buy all the real estate, it's just going to slow you down. Now, there does become a point in time where, you know, you get to a certain amount of locations, maybe it's 80, 100, 150, whatever, where it's like, okay, at this stage, you've probably got a lot more liquidity, right? You've probably got a lot of access to capital and things like that. And it kind of starts to make sense to where you can start to buy some of that real estate. And it's not going to slow down your growth as much. But during that early hyper growth stages, I mean, you definitely got to ask yourself that question, what do I want more, right? That high security or high growth? Because a lot of times they come in opposition to each other. And that's usually like the best example.
Okay, yeah, I love that answer. I loved hearing your answer. While I was answering, I was sweating. I was like, boy, I'm answering this with Austin.
You and I share like the exact same opinion. So, no, that's good. You know, how often are groups, like when a group comes to you that's got 3 or 4 and then they scale at 15 and they sell, how often have they acquired real estate that they're selling in that transaction or either keeping? Like, how often do those groups of 15 like own some of their real estate before they take the chips off the table?
Almost everyone owns some of it, whether it was early on and then as capital got tighter, they started leasing more. I would say the ones that are 7+, I would bet on the side of, I bet you they own at least one of their locations.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And then do they usually sell, or do they usually hold the real estate as when they sell to a bigger group?
They usually hold it. The group usually doesn't want the real estate, so then we'll have to get, you know, fair market valuations and, you know, paper everything up and you know, they become our tenant. So that's usually what ends up happening. We've seen a couple that they put a right of first refusal on the agreements, on the purchase agreements, but we haven't seen any that have bought it with the
deal. Are there, Dental is mostly growing through acquisition, but there are some de novos as well. Would you say MedSpa is the same, like mostly growth through acquisition, or are you seeing a lot of de novos too?
Right now, the MedSpa space, because most of the growth is happening from people like you and me, and not necessarily investors, we see a lot of de novo in the space. I think that's about to change and is changing today, meaning investors are now getting into it and heavily so. And almost all of them have an acquisition strategy. So I think the future is that there will be growing by M&A strategy, but you still see a lot of de novos simply because there are a lot of single solo med spas right now. It's not a very mature space, unlike
dental. Yeah. So four barriers to growth to overcome that I see. One is competition, which you always have that. You just got to deal with it, right? You're never going to get away from that. But two is interest rates, rising interest rates. I mean, that's just going to increase your cost of doing business as you try and take on bank debt and as you try and scale and as you try and do whatever. And then, of course, the third thing is the great resignation that we talked about, which is people just don't want to work for whatever reason. Every single person in every single industry is struggling to find people, right? It's something that's not, hasn't historically been the case. I'll give you a statistic that I heard recently. In the great financial crisis, you know, the recession that ensued, there was 6 applicants for every 1 job opening. Now, in 2022, there's 0.6 applicants for every job opening, right? That's a massive transition. And then, you know, the fourth thing would just be supply chain issues. It's like, you know, the cost of it, like if it takes you 14 months to get a piece of equipment that you need, that's a huge opportunity cost. So I know that's a lot, like that's a loaded question, but like in general, you know, how do you see that unfolding, right? Is it gonna slow people down? Are they just gonna have to accept lower margins? You know, is it going to cause a recession? Like, obviously, you don't know the answer to that, but I'm just curious your opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, at least for the time being, it's going to cause lower margins. I think we're seeing that a little bit in the dental space, meaning payroll percentage already has gone up. I think everyone in the industry is in general agreement that it's probably gone up a couple percentage points. I think, to your point, it does make people nervous. We've heard it from our clients. If I do add another office, how the heck am I going to find talent? Yeah. I mean, that's a big concern. And oh, by the way, with the talent that I do have, I don't want to lose them because, by the way, your team members know that the you know, practice next door who is hiring is going to pay you X per hour, which is higher than you're making now. So a lot of our clients are being proactive around, you know what, I'm going to bring everybody up to market, or should I bring everybody up to market? Somewhat that Netflix model, right? Of don't just give people a 3-4% raise, but bring them up to market every year. And we're seeing a lot of that, which also cuts into margins. And so, yeah, I think whenever things like this happen, high inflationary period, you know, we've got some geopolitical things going on. Those are more macro level, but I think it affects people's psyche. So we have seen a little bit more of conservatism as far as future growth. I do think it has to level out, though. I think human beings always figure it out. And I think this will be a momentary bump that will eventually come out of. I think people are going to have to come back to work. I think people are going to want to come back to work. I think everybody likes to have a purpose. But I do think that momentarily we are seeing some bumps and we're taking some bruises along the way from it.
Yeah, totally. I agree. It's quite the conundrum. What I just can't wrap my head around is, like, what are all these people doing for money? Like, the people that are not, like, we have 0.6 applicants for every job opening, right? It's like, we stopped the PPP money a while back. You know, like you said, we humans are problem solvers. We have a tendency to figure it out. I do believe we're in a secular bull market. You know, this correction, I don't think we're going to go into like a depression, or, you know, we might hit the technical definition for a bear market. Or even a recession, right? Like technically, but I mean, there's still so we've never had a recession with unemployment this low, and so it's just like, you know, we live in such fast times. Every time you blink, there's something new that's going on that's blowing your mind. But yeah, I don't really know what to make of it. You know, the only thing I know for sure is you can't just sit on the sidelines, right, and not do anything and try and time the market perfectly, because nobody can do that, right? You got to keep going. You got to keep moving forward. I mean, it just seems like in the short term, the only real answer is to accept lower margins, right? Until you can figure this out, and then hopefully you can continue and normalize things later on. But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting some of the things you said. Like in the U.S. this last year, read that it was we had the lowest births per person, per family ever recorded in the United States. So you see things like that. And, you know, eventually we've got to figure it out because we need workforce. We need people to fill the jobs and things of that nature. So, you know, that's going to become interesting. That's something Europe's been dealing with for a long, long time. You know, we're getting into a different realm here of discussion. But yeah, I think all those things are things we're going to have to solve for. And I do think, like you said, I think for the time being, in one of the things we like to talk about is, you can't beat the market, right? The market is what it is. So there's no point in saying, oh, last year we paid X 18 an hour. Now it's 22 an hour. We like to say it is what it is. Like macro market things you cannot control. And I think it's wise to just go ahead and accept, okay, this is what's market. Whatever market is across the space, accept it and do what you can. So like under your sphere of influence, what is it that you can do? You can always build an efficient business. You can always build a good team, good culture, keep your talent. There are things that you do have control over. And just keep in mind that everybody's going through what you're going through. And that's really, I think, where your mindset ought to be. Not too dissimilar from what we told our clients during PPP, which is, hey, look, you used to complain to me all the time that you didn't have time. That right, and you were like trying to fix the engine while the car was on the highway going 100 miles an hour. Well, now the car is parked in the garage. Go work on the engine that we were always trying to work on as we were hectic, and control what you can and come out of it a stronger business, relatively speaking, to your peers. And I think that's exactly where we are today in this period. You know, high inflation, difficulty finding talent, the great resignation, as you said, Austin, and really just look at what is it that we can control. We always like to say thoughts lead to actions, actions lead to the results. So if you're fearful, that's a result you're going to get. If, however, you say, look, these are the things that I can control and make my organization and team better, that's what you're going
to
get.
I like that. Thoughts leads to action. Action leads to results. Yeah. Because you can only control what's within your own sphere, like what's within your personal role of responsibility anyways, right? So that's cool. That's a great perspective. I know I want to be respectful of your time. What's a good way for somebody to get in touch with you? You know, if they want to learn more about what you're doing or find out more information or something like that.
Yeah, you know, easy way to get in touch with me. My email is ben.hernandez@skytailgroup.com. And Skytail Group is SKYTALE group.com. That's an easy way to get a hold of me. That's also our website. And you can kind of look up, you know, the team and, you know, general email there as well.
Okay. And anything that I missed that you want to talk about before we wrap it up here?
I don't think so. I think, you know, this was such a fun conversation. I really liked the way you took it. You kind of took it into kind of macro things that are probably in a lot of your listeners' minds right now, in addition to talking about our space a little bit, which is always fun. And glad I answered that real estate question correctly.
A-plus.
Real Estate University behind you.
Awesome. But, well, thanks very much for your time, and looking forward to seeing you here in the future.
Likewise, thank you so much for the time, Austin. Really appreciate your having me on.
If you need help finding the perfect location for your practice, or you're ready to invest in commercial real estate, email us podcast@leadersre.com. That's podcast@leadersre.com. Or go to leadersre.com and fill out our form. See you next time.